It's time for the Turfgrass Zealot Audiocast. From the worldwide command center of intergalactic turfheads, it's the Turfgrass Zealot Audiocast. Only on Turfnet Radio. With a chief turfhead, the guru of fescue, the Alatollah of iron, Mr. Dave Wilbur. There's only one zealot, only on Turfnet Radio.
Hello, turf heads. Hello, turf monkeys. It's me, it's Dave Wilbur, and I am the host of the Turfgrass Zealot Project, and you are listening to episode number 18. We're brought to you today by Clingstone. They've given us proven bunker performance for over 15 years, and we're on the Turfnet Radio Network, and we're loving this, really, just having a really good time. And today, my good time comes at the hands of a really great golf course superintendent, somebody I admire, somebody I've loved reading. Jason Haynes is here from Pender Harbor Golf Links up in British Columbia. And Jason's going to talk about his world. He's going to talk about how he got to be the superintendent there. And we're going to talk about agronomy. And for those of you who think that I don't talk about agronomy anymore, let me tell you something. We're going to dig in today. We're going to dig in hard, have some turf head time. And I can't think of a more fun turf head than to do the minimalist thing with than Jason Haynes. So stick around. I'll be right back with Jason Haynes.
The Turfgrass Zealot Project is presented by Clingstone, the original patented liquid applied bunker barrier. Clingstone has been stopping sand contamination, eliminating erosion, and stabilizing bunker faces for over 15 years. Nobody else can say that. For more information, visit clingstone.com.
Well, my guest today on the Turfgrass Zealot Project is somebody that this is so cool. Jason Haynes is here. Hello, Jason. How's it going?
Hey, how's it going?
So, Jason is, dude, how do I explain this to you? Like, I'm a little starstruck. I really am. I've been reading your stuff for so long, you know, both on your blog site and on Twitter. And I think probably... the number of favorites and the number of likes and the number of thumbs ups and all that sort of stuff, you know, I mean, you've got to be the leader for me and somebody that I just go, yeah, I'm glad he said that. Or, yeah, that's exactly right. And, I just love you. So I kind of, we've never met and I sort of feel like you're kind of a brother and I love that. And I wanted to have you on the Turfgrass Zealot Project for a while now. And I was just kind of waiting for that perfect moment, and I think the perfect moment is here because I think people are just starting to talk about and think about, coming into the season, whatever the season means for them. I mean, I realize we have a lot of people in, you know, all over the world really listening, and season means different things, you know, to different people. But springtime, you know, is that time when we all start to think about growing grass a little bit more. A little bit less education and a little bit more planning, right?
Yeah. It's kind of, you know, the time where we're, starting to enact our plans that we've, all the stuff we've been reading and researching over the winter, we're starting to act on them now.
Right. Putting stuff into motion. Right. And and to me, like, you're a motion kind of guy. That's what it's all about. All right. So let's get to you for just a second. I mean, I want you to talk to me a minute about like where you are. You know, give us a little bit of 411 on your geography and your situation there. Yeah.
We're in Canada on the West Coast. I'm at a 9-hole course, and we're in a little town called Pender Harbor or Madeira Park. It's about 2,000 people. It's quite seasonal. It used to be, you know, big fishing town, logging. Now it's mostly tourism. We're located about 100 kilometers north of Vancouver, which is about 60 miles. But we're on the mainland, but we're only accessible by ferry because we're surrounded by these deep fjords. It's like as you're going north up North America, the first fjords that you come across is Howe Sound, which is we have to take a ferry to get across because they can't build a road. It's a 45-minute ferry ride from Vancouver, which is kind of nice because it kind of keeps the craziness of the city away.
But
at the same time, you know, in 2 hours, I can be in you know, one of the biggest cities in Canada, which is really nice.
So the ferry is a big part of your life. And this is interesting because, you know, Matt Crowther was on with me, and the ferry is a big part of his life on Martha's Vineyard. I mean, do you go back and forth to Vancouver much, or like,
no,
when you're there, you're there?
It was funny when I was listening to your discussion with him, and, you know, like, there's so many similarities, but no, we have everything we need on the Sunshine Coast. There's about 40,000 people that live on this side of the ferry, basically.
Okay.
So if I need something, I can get it. You know, the ferry, it costs $80.
Oh, so, wow. A round trip is $80?
Yeah, and it's ridiculous. There's all sorts of controversy here, you know, because it's a, you know, people say it should be subsidized by the government because it's our only way of getting across, whatever. Yeah. But luckily for us, I don't have to. I don't need to go to Vancouver. And you know, there's just enough services here that we just don't need to go anywhere.
Right. So you're there and you love it. So it's not like it's not like you mind. It doesn't sound like you mind it from the things I've seen you post. You know, right?
No, I love it. I love it here. It's unbelievable. And, you know, like, you know, in the wintertime, there's nobody here, and which is nice. And then in the summer, there's 2 or 3 months where it's just insane, super busy. And then, but we put up with it because it pays for us to live here, basically, the tourism. And,
sure.
So it's really a nice part of the world.
But yet, I mean, it really doesn't snow there and stuff. So when you're talking about the winter, I mean, it still can be pretty nice, right?
Yeah, you know, like, we're the nicest, probably the most moderate. Well, we are the most moderate climate in Canada. It's exactly the same as Seattle, right? A little bit colder, but not by much. We get the odd snowfall in the winter. It's regular to get below freezing temperatures, but nothing crazy.
Yeah.
This year it's been really warm because of the El Nino.
Right.
It's been so nice. Like, we've already had temperatures in the high teens, which is in, I guess, the 60s for Americans. So the grass is starting to move, but you know, we are one of the most northern golf courses in North America that is open year round.
Uh-huh.
I think there's only maybe a handful of courses north of us that are open year round. So it kind of is extreme. It's, you know, there's not much light up here in the winter. It's really wet, so it's not like I'm not growing grass in the winter.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
Yeah. So right, with the short days and the ground's not frozen, but the soil temperatures are down. It's wet.
Yeah,
it's pretty, you know. But I know you told me like today is like a pretty day. So
it's unbelievable.
Golf course is open. People are playing golf today, right?
Yeah, place is packed. We didn't even expect this weather. We have a string of storms coming off the Pacific right now, and this is just the tail end of one. And it just hit on a Saturday, and it's sunny and warm. It's a bit windy, but you know, the place is packed, and I wasn't expecting a single golfer today, so it's kind of a nice thing. Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about your situation a little bit more. So how many guys have you got in your crew? What does your staff look like?
So I'm the only person on staff for maintenance that's year-round. We used to have two, but we've downsized. I have another guy, another full-time guy who's on for 8 months a year, and he does most of the mowing.
Okay.
And then I hire on two part-timers, which is something I've done new in the last 3 years, 2 or 3 years.
Uh-huh.
Is hire two guys for 4 hours a day instead of one guy for 8 hours a day. And that gives me more bodies in the morning when I'm the most efficient. You know, the staff are fresh in the morning. They're working faster. There's no golfers. So that's been, and it's actually easier for me to hire guys, in our demographic here, for part-time versus full-time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I had basically three full-time guys or two full-time guys and two half-time guys.
And yourself. So cool. Yeah. And then, so how long have you been there, Jason? Like, what's your, tell me about your history to get there.
Yeah, I started here in 2001 when I was 15 years old. I was like weed whacking, doing yard work for some of the founding members. And then the job came up and I applied, and I did not think I was going to get it because I thought every kid would want to work here.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, my interview was, you know, come out, start the weed whacker, and then drive the gator around the clubhouse. And I got the job because, you know, I had pretty good references when the club founders, you work for them already.
Right. Right.
I started then, and I've loved every second of it ever since. I think, was it 2003, I graduated high school, and then I went and got my turf grass diploma in Northern Alberta. At Fairview College, which no longer exists. But like a ton of guys in Canada have gone to Fairview.
Right.
Like one of your previous guests, Andrew Hardy, he went there.
I was just going to say that's where Andrew went. Exactly.
Yeah. So it was the place to go, until they closed it down just from lack of enrollment and anything else. So did that, and then I, that was 2 years, and then they offered me a ton of money to come back. I came back, and then the year later, it was a ton of money back then anyways to a kid. And,
right.
Yeah, now it's like, now you kind of laugh about it. And
right.
Then,
your hourly wage, but
it was a lot more than anybody else was willing to pay at that time. And so I came back, and then the year later, the superintendent decided to get out of the business. So then I became the super when I was 20 years old. And this is my 10th year now here as the superintendent.
Wow.
Is kind of crazy to think. I'm 30 and it's just like a whirlwind. I think back and I can't believe I've been here that long.
That's cool. That's so cool. I think back in the day, that was a fairly common story, you know, getting your golf course superintendent's job when you were 20, 22, something like that, you know, your first gig.
Yep.
And, we don't hear that as much anymore, but I think that, you know, especially where this is where you started working when you were a kid thing. I mean, that's such a cool story. So cool.
Yeah. It's a pretty unique thing in the industry these days to be able to do that. And I'm lucky that I'm in my hometown and there's only one job that I am qualified to do in this town. And I have it, luckily. there could have been the superintendent. He could still be a superintendent if he wanted to. And he could have stayed here for another 20 years.
Right.
He was here for 20 years prior. I was just really lucky the stars aligned and I'm also lucky that I love it so much. My original goals when I was a kid, are a lot different than they are today as far as, where I want to work and everything else and what I look for and out of a job. So,
Very cool. Having grown up in a small place myself, and I know a lot of us, all we wanted to do was get out of there.
Exactly.
Like just trying to figure out how to get the hell out.
And I was kind of lucky because college was so far away, it was like a 2-day drive to get there. It was so far away. And then after college, I did a stint working at a ski resort, running snowcats and in the Okanagan Valley, which is kind of like the warmest place in Canada. It's like semi-desert, semi-arid, similar to kind of like Southern California in the summer.
Right.
And so it's like crazy busy and there's sandy beaches everywhere. I was there and it's like, this is supposed to be the nicest place in Canada. And I was like, I think where I grew up is better. And every time I do leave, I come back to the coast. And I'm like, man, this place is the best place in the world.
Well, it sounds like paradise to me. I mean, and looking at the map,
it really is.
Looks like the place a lot of people want to be. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. So now I want to just there's some other stuff about you that's pretty cool. You're involved in search and rescue stuff, right? Tell me about that.
Yeah. I started that in 2008 for selfish reasons. I'm pretty straight up with everybody. It's free training. That was the original reason, backcountry training, because it's really expensive to get that training.
Absolutely.
So you join up, you commit a bunch of time, and they'll train you in anything you want to do. Kind of like the military, except it's a lot less commitment than the military, obviously being volunteer. I did that, and I kind of just hung low for a few years there, and then now I'm kind of in a leadership position. Just after I gained enough knowledge and experience to kind of be able to contribute to the team in a more meaningful way. So,
and so, give me a hint about like what's your latest SNR thing that you participated in? What's common? You know, are you on call kind of thing, or how does that work?
Yeah. We're on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Oh, wow.
And like, I'm the only rope rescue team leader on the Sunshine Coast. So when I leave, I need to tell people when I'm gone because they need to make arrangements just so that we're covered. If somebody needs a high angle rescue, like off a cliff or down a ravine or something. Luckily, those incidents don't happen very often, but they do happen enough that we need to be pretty careful. We had our busiest year ever last year in search and rescue. But this year we haven't had a single call, knock on wood. So, it's so far so good. Like I don't like getting calls,
sure, you know, of course,
but at the same time, I don't not like getting calls. You know, we do have a lot of fun with it, and it's nice to be able to help people.
You bet. And then is part of your stuff kind of maritime and, you know, ocean oriented too, or is it more land based?
No, in Canada, the oceans, they're federal land and the search and rescue is provincial. So I do anything that's not ocean.
Okay.
So we have the Royal Canadian Marine Search and Rescue, and there's three groups on the Sunshine Coast that cover the waters because there's a lot of water here. So they have three separate groups, and then we only have one group for the land. And that's the group I'm involved with about 30 volunteers.
Oh, very cool. Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
it's
a lot of fun.
Are you an extreme sorts kind of guy? Are you like a climber and a hiker and a jump off cliffs kind of guy or what?
I am in a really wimpy way. I really don't like getting hurt and I don't like being, irresponsible, especially I got a family and a job that I'm committed to. But I did longboarding when I was in high school. I stopped that. Stop that in my early 20s. But, you know, going 80, 90 kilometers an hour, which is, you know, getting close to 50, 60 miles per hour on a skateboard is pretty extreme, I guess.
Oh, I love that. I love
that. That was fun. I still enjoy going out every once in a while, except the crashes are really consequential. you pay for it. And then skiing, I was a bit wild there when I worked at the ski hill, but nothing crazy. I wasn't hitting any big jumps.
Yeah.
Go fast. Rock climbing. I love rock climbing, but again, the way it is in reality isn't how it's portrayed on in the media. It's a pretty safe sport. It's about as safe as golf. Really,
right. If you're doing it right.
Yeah.
And then, Whistler's not far away. So do you go ski now or you?
Well, I used to go skiing a ton before I had kids, but Whistler, it's like $100 to ski there for a day.
Yeah.
I just went though. I went a couple weeks ago. We had a turf conference in Whistler this year. So I got a day in and skied with a few local superintendents and had a lot of fun.
Oh, that's cool. Turf heads on skis. That's always a good thing.
Yep.
All right. So let's switch gears, man. Let's talk about some agronomy. I just wanted people to get to know you and where you're at and stuff. And cause it's a fascinating story. So what I want you to do is take me back some years ago. Just looking at your stuff, looking at your blog for, as long as I have and stuff, I'm hoping I get some years right here, but you're going to have to correct me. I want to understand what happened in, maybe 2008, 2009, that made you start thinking way different about your whole program, and how you manage Pender Harbor.
Yeah, well, basically the economy collapsed.
Okay. So,
I saw that, and it hit where we are really especially hard because we're tourism. And all of a sudden, people's money, and we're also retirement. Over 30 to 40% of our population is retired. So all their money, all their, investments dried right up, gone overnight. It was something that I saw and something I consider myself lucky and maybe I was wise. I wasn't really, it's really hard to tell the future, but I saw that and I put the brakes on pretty hard here, in anticipation for some tough years.
Okay.
And And that kind of led me to, well, you know, just the interest in the minimalistic kind of turf grass movement. And that's kind of where my interest has been ever since. Because with minimalism, it's kind of cool to be poor. You know, like the less money you spend, you know, the awesomer you are, kind of thing. You know, I'd never seen that before. I'd only been, you know, especially before I got online and everything else, it's kind of, you get kind of sucked into, you know, and what you see on TV is all these super green, super high-end courses. So that's all you ever see. And especially being in an isolated spot like where I am, it's kind of hard to get that different perspective. But I came across some pretty cool people online, and whether or not they know it or not, they helped me to basically save my operation by just being open and sharing what they were doing.
I see. So let me just make sure I get this right. So really, you know, it wasn't agronomy that forced your change. It was economy, which I think is true for lots of people. And it was about 2008. And so you're like, wow, I gotta do this different. I don't, you know, it wasn't just about want to, it's like, I got to.
And what I was doing before was honestly pretty boring. I really wasn't very satisfied with my job. I had been a superintendent for a couple of years and I was already like, okay, I'm done with this. This isn't any fun. You know, just going out and kind of just, I just go off the records of my predecessor and just do that again. You know, there was no thinking. There was no creativity, the way I was doing it anyways. And then also, I guess another thing that forced change here was we had a pesticide ban on the horizon.
Okay.
They were threatening to take away, you know, all our cosmetic pesticides, as they call them, and that kind of got me kind of moving along that the ecological environmental kind of movement, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that is a somewhat common story, you know, for a lot of people that economy forced agronomic change. But I mean, in your situation, you took this a little bit, like took it pretty seriously, didn't you, dude? And you say, well, I looked online and I saw a few things or whatever, but somewhere in your thinking, you were pretty fearless about change. Like, tell me about that.
Well, like with the pesticide ban, for example, I looked at what everybody was doing, and everybody was putting, everybody was putting all of their efforts into fighting the ban. And that was great because, you know, the ban was based on fear and misinformation. But at the same time, I'm like, what if after all of this fighting, we still get banned? You know, what if? Like, what if they take away our products? What are we going to do? And so that's where I kind of switched gears with my blog we need to share on a not just like a, you know, super to super and, you know, a conference kind of, which is pretty limited. I think we need to share on a grander scale what we're doing, what works and what doesn't work so that we can move forward in case they take our pesticides away. Mm-hmm. So that was a kind of an inspiration for me in the early years anyways.
Well, I think that's a really good point, Jason, is that a lot of times when somebody says, hey, man, we're going to fight the power, right?
Yeah.
There's no plan for what happens if that fight doesn't go well.
Like exactly.
You put all your thinking and all your resources into the battle, and it's like, okay, what happens? You know, like let's say there has to be a compromise. What happens? Nobody's really thinking about that stuff because they're so busy involved in the, you know, in the boxing match. Yeah,
exactly. For the most part, that's true. Our local turf grass association was actually pretty good. I wrote with my concerns to them and I said, you know, what are we doing? And they've spent a ton of money funding research down in like Oregon and Washington for Fusarium, which is our, you know, Mycodochium, which is our pretty much number one disease on the West Coast. So they were doing that. They were doing that too. But, you know, one university can only do so much research, right? And then I started trying to share what I was doing and trying what other people were doing, and I felt that if I was as open and shared as much as possible, then maybe that other people would feel better about sharing what they were doing.
So what was your first big success along those lines? I mean, what could you, when you say share, like what could you share that was like, this is becoming a win for me?
Yeah. I don't know. It's really hard to say. Looking back, I've made huge reductions in fertilizer. Pesticides, quantifying the success of pesticides is really, really, really hard. That's something I've learned. This number of apps, does that matter? Does the amount of active ingredient matter? Like, how do we measure toxicity? It's really hard for me to definitively say I'm, way better than I was when I started, but I definitely have more tools now and I have a better understanding of what's happening out on the course. I guess the biggest success probably is the amount of fertilizer. I've been able to cut the cost of fertilizer by 90%, the amount of fertilizer we've cut by 75% of actual product going out of the course, and conditions have just gotten better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. So, and again, I can hear that, that economy was driving that. But from an agronomy standpoint, it's like, okay, I've got to cut back on my fertilizer here. I mean, we just don't have the money. And there must have been a point when you started to go, wait a minute, things are getting better. Like the book says that I'm not doing what I should have been doing, quote unquote, by the book, right? But like my golf course is getting better. There must have been a point where the light came on a little bit, right?
Yeah, it continues to come on because I'm still kind of learning. Like, when I look back to, what we were doing 20 years in previous, it's, we were applying way too much product and really had no idea of what we were doing. And I still, it's incredibly complex. I still struggle with understanding what exactly I'm doing out here. The more I simplified things, the easier it was for me to understand the impact of every little thing I was doing. I took a lot of the complicated things out and just went really back to basics. And I think when I did that, I went out and I'd apply a little bit of ammonium sulfate and I could see the results of that. And I went out and I applied, I didn't apply calcium and I could see the results of that, on my teas, for example. I continue to be amazed. Right today out this morning cutting greens, so I'm just like, wow, this place is, I can't believe the way it looks right now with how little I've done to it.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I'm going to keep picking your brain about this a little bit, Jason. Yep. So I'm going to jump around a little. So let's get back to the environmental side of it for a second.
Yep.
I remember one of the first things that really picked my interest about you was the EIQ stuff that you were working with.
Yeah.
And then what I loved is that you kind of were getting in the middle of that, of the environmental quotient stuff. And then you said, wait a minute, this formula is a little flawed, right? Like you were pretty brave about that. And I was like, oh, I like this guy.
if you're going to be real with yourself, like there's no point in lying to yourself. I have done that in the past, especially like when I first started blogging and kind of being open. It's hard not to lie to yourself. I'm not a scientist. I'm just a greenskeeper. And when I read papers from other scientists and they're saying, hey, this is flawed, this system that you know and love is flawed, then, I got to take their word for it. And you got to realize that.
So let's back up for a second. Explain the environmental impact quotient as you first started to get involved with it. Like, tell me how you came to that and what it means a little bit for the people that maybe haven't heard that term before. Us no pesticide guys know this one, right?
Yeah. I was struggling quantifying my pesticide use on the course. And I, in the past, I had used number of applications, amount of active ingredient, which a lot of people do, but those don't really mean anything. Like I can go out with a low volume fungicide, mm-hmm. and immediately it looks like I'm a superhero because I'm applying less product, when really, who knows what impact it has on the environment. That's the whole concern with pesticides, right? What's their impact on the environment? So I came across EIQ, and I came across it first from the Turf Hugger website, which has kind of gone into disarray, but, mm-hmm. but it back in, 10 years ago now, it was awesome. And it showed the environmental impact of pesticides in a way that made sense. Even though it's not perfect, I think it's still today probably the best tool we have. But it's apparently it's a little bit too influenced by the concentration of the pesticide or something like that. Anyways, so it's still better than measuring amount of active ingredient, but not much better. But it's slightly better, so you might as well use it.
Right. So there's kind of two methods, right? One was always, hey, how many pounds of active ingredient am I putting down? I mean, it didn't matter what it was. It was like per acre, per thousand. Like when I had done, regulatory IPM type work, that there was a lot of people, before we were really talking about best practices and stuff, people just wanted to know how many pounds of active ingredient went out per acre, per thousand square feet, per, thousand square meters, whatever. And that's how we talked about it. And then Cornell comes up with the environmental impact quotient thing, which says, well, we really need to take toxicity of not just the pounds of active into, like some active ingredients are more toxic than others, and we should be looking at that, right?
How toxic it is to bees, how toxic it is to fish,
and
how prone is it to leaching, how long does it last in the environment? All these things, and that's what it does. Is it does take all those into account. Mm-hmm. So which is great. It's still. I hope that they can improve upon it and make it a better system.
Sure.
So that it's more meaningful. But anyway, when I came across EIQ, it was for the first time I could make a little bit of sense of what I was doing, and it turned out that I wasn't actually making that big of a difference with some of the crazy things I was trying originally.
Give me an example of that. Like, give me an example of when you realized, oh, that really didn't make that much environmental difference between...
When you tally up, I would go back, when we were using like products like Quintazine, which we can't use anymore, mm-hmm. it had a EIQ of like 800 per app, which is high, like something like
that's a big number, right?
Something like azoxystrobin is like 6, right? So this has quintazine is 800. It's huge, and some products like chlorothalonil is like a 300.
Yeah.
And I looked at where my EIQ was, and I was like, well, if I stop using that one product, I can cut it in half, pretty easy. So that's kind of what I did. Like last year, I didn't use any chlorothalonil. And all of a sudden you look like a rock star as far as the EIQ goes, even though it's, I'm probably using, more of other products,
That all makes sense. And so at what point did you say, hey, I love this to a point, but there's still a flaw in it. Tell me about that a little bit, cause that's reading that going, wow, this guy's thinking really good.
You got to realize that it's flawed and be open, I guess, to new ways of thinking. I still think it's the best way of doing it, even though it's not perfect. And then also taking in for like economy wise is cost. And that's something that I think has been quite meaningful. It really does reflect, to me, it reflects not just how much you're spending, but how much you are reducing. If you can spend a lot less, you're doing something right, I think. I don't know really where to go. Like I'm still kind of in the middle of things when it comes to the EIQ. It's flawed, but what else do we have?
Sure. And so I think to simplify that a little bit is like, okay, we're looking at sustainability and we're looking at you know, changing things around a little bit and maybe using less active ingredient, less things per acre or whatever. But if we use something that's more toxic, we really haven't, we haven't changed our overall environmental footprint. We just have lessened something, you know. I think that's...
Yeah, we reduce, like, if we use something that's more toxic but can last twice as long, then we're just reducing the amount, number of apps we have to make, but we're not really making a difference environmentally, I don't think. So I think it's... And, you know, looking back, you know, I start doing the math here, and it's like, geez, if I go out every 2 weeks with Heritage, my EIQ is going to be way less than if I, if I'm, you know, farting around like I've been doing. And although my cost is going to be way higher. It's been trying to find a balance for me between cost and how effective it is and the environmental impact. And I think, like, the moral, what I've learned by tracking EIQ is find out where the big hitters are. What products, like Quintazine, which we can't use anyways, or chlorothalonil, which we're probably going to have taken away from us or heavily restricted in Canada. Mm-hmm. Take those out of your program if you can, and you're going to make a big difference on the environmental impact. As far as, you know, visually, like, will you be able to tell? Probably not. But the science is saying that it's better. So why not try to be better?
There we go. I love it.
It's really hard. Like, how do you tell environmental impact just by looking at something, right? You go there and spray it. It's a really complicated thing.
There you go. All right, let's switch gears for a second again. I'm just going to take us all over your map here. Because I like it. I think this is how you think. I think you're kind of all over. And I do the same sort of thing. So let's talk about fusarium. Let's talk about microdopium for a minute. And I mean, in Western Canada, on the West Coast, in coastal areas, you know, and when the weather's right, man, that stuff can be, it's gnarly, right? Gnarly.
Yeah. It's like 9 months a year. It's a problem. it is. And I've learned a ton about it over the years. And, you know, I'm getting pictures, like, you go, superintendents, they send me pictures, you know, every week of, like, holy smokes, look at this. And, like, these guys it can wipe you out. And like, I've posted pictures, you know, everyone's seen on my blog, you know, how devastating it can be. But at the same time, I don't think it's as bad as we have made it to be. Something I'm learning. I think we're making it worse by management decisions.
It's not the coastal boogeyman that a lot of people think it is. I agree with that. So talk to me about some of your management decisions and what those impacts have been.
You know, well, a couple of years ago, I kind of noticed that, hey, on my approaches, the fusarium is like 10 times as bad. What about my approaches is making it worse? So I start really focusing in on what I'm doing to my approaches. And the only thing that I could find that was different than any other spot that was less bad with the disease was it got mowed twice. It got twice as much mower traffic. And it, you know, our greens mowers are turning on the approaches, so that the tire traffic, which wasn't a big deal, I don't think. But the approach mower cuts it, and then the ferry mower comes up and overlaps a bit. So it was getting double the amount of mower traffic, and it was reflected in the amount of disease. So I was like, holy smokes. I think that, you know, we're making it worse by cutting our grass through the winter time, which is when it's a problem, right? It's not really a problem in the summer when we're mowing like crazy.
Right.
But our climate is warm enough that if we fertilize our grass in the winter time and we keep it going, we can keep it growing. Like I could make it, you know, and some guys do, they're out mowing every week in the winter time. And I think you're just spreading the disease around. I got a picture this morning from a superintendent just down the road, and he's like, yep, I'm starting to think you're right. And there's this disease spot, and there's about 200 of them in a straight line right down the middle of the screen.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I've been doing is not mowing. And it, I don't know, it's been pretty good, I think. So
there was a caption on your blog once, Jason, that completely blew my mind. I sat there and I just was like, I am so, like, it made me happy to be in the business at that moment. because I get tired of people not thinking and not observing, right? I mean, I'm always bitching at people, you know, please observe better, you know, use the tools, use the things that are available to you. And there was a picture that you posted of some fusarium, and the caption was, and I got it right here in front of me, so I get it right. It says, preventative fungicides applications would have robbed me the opportunity to observe how this disease is spread by mowers.
Yeah, I agree. And
I was like, I was honestly speechless, dude. Like I was like, that is some of the best stuff ever, you know?
So like there's guys out there that don't know what fusarium looks like on the West Coast.
Right.
And I'm not saying that's wrong. Like that's maybe a product of the club that they're at and the expectations and everything else. I've always said I'm incredibly lucky to be kind of at a golf course in the middle of nowhere here, pretty low key. The expectations aren't crazy. Mm-hmm. Like the highest expectations of the course are probably my own expectations.
Right.
I've never had a comment about disease, and people have seen the pictures I post. They're like horrifying to a turf grass manager. But I've never had a golfer ever in 10 years mention the disease on the grass. Not once. Single comment. So going back to the preventative apps, I've never done preventative apps. It's kind of, I don't know, the way they taught us was always IPM. You monitor to the pest, then you make a decision if you pass a certain threshold. I don't think a lot of people take that seriously. But if you are constantly keeping the disease at bay, you don't notice these patterns that are really obvious, and other people are starting to notice it. Like I'm getting so much correspondence from people. They're starting to notice these crazy things now that they're not going out preventatively. Yes, there's maybe some issues with efficacy. I know none of the academics will recommend it, but I think I look at pesticides as antibiotics. And if you were to take antibiotics as a person preventatively, that's insane, right? Like everybody would be like, what are you doing?
Sure.
And I think that's kind of something that we're doing to our grass. I have a pretty, pretty high disease threshold. Tolerance probably higher than most. So that's my thoughts on preventative apps is they cover up what the grass is trying to tell you.
Okay. So you're done with the preventative apps and now you're seeing how the disease actually works, right?
Yeah.
And you're changing your fertilization program.
Yep.
And what happens?
Well, it's really hard to say, because it's so complex, disease and everything else, but I don't get disease outbreaks like I used to. So like I used to, you know, you'd go out in the morning, look at your greens, everything's great. Next day you come out, beautiful. Third day you come out and there's like 20,000 spots on your greens.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like I used to come out in the summer and just be completely caught off guard, smoked the dollar spot overnight.
Right.
Nothing one day. The next day it's so bad that you're like, if I don't get something down on this, I'm not going to have any grass left in 2 or 3 days. Right. And it was the same with fusarium. It was the same with brown patch, anthracnose, everything would come on so hard. And now, you know, oh, there's a spot of fusarium. And it's so little now that I can go out and I actually literally count the number of spots on all my greens. And it's like, oh, there's 50 new spots today. Well, that's, last week I checked there was, 45 new spots. So it's only 5 more spots than last week.
Yeah.
So it comes on really slow. But I think that probably is also has a lot to do with phosphite.
Right.
Which is a big component of my program, which some will say, yeah, that's preventative fungicide, I guess. And they're right. But it's a different mode of action, right? It's not fungistatic.
Exactly. Sure.
Induced systemic resistance, whatever they call it.
Yep, systemically induced resistance, right? SIR, whatever. You gloss over this kind of stuff, Jason, but like what a brilliant observation. That's not really a fungicide. It's part of my program. I'm seeing things be different. So cool.
The thing, if we talk about the ISRs, the thing I like about them is that they do work. They do reduce the amount of disease you have, but at the same time, they still allow the disease. You're still going to see disease. Where if you're using a fungicide, you're not going to see the disease. Mm-hmm. And I like to I always tell guys, your most powerful tools for managing grass are your eyes.
Right.
And
observation. So
you can't see where. Looking at it.
Okay, so all of these things are happening, and then the next thing, just in progression from reading your stuff, is you start to develop bentgrass populations that you didn't have before, right?
Yeah, early on, and a lot of the stuff that I'm talking about on my blog, it's not necessarily that I noticed it first, but other people would mention something, and then I would go back to my course and be like, oh, wow, look at that. So, one of those guys early on who has been your guest on this podcast was Chris Tritabaugh.
Chris.
And, he was at Northland, he was promoting Bent, he's talking about these minimalistic things that he was doing. And I was doing similar things. And then I go out and I'm like, oh, wow, I actually have bent grass. And it was less than 1%, like super small amount. But I'm like, it looks pretty happy. And so then what I started doing is like, well, the way I'm managing my greens is good for bentgrass, or bentgrass likes it, then why don't I get some more bentgrass into them, so there's a more even population. Probably since 2012 till last year, I overseeded super light. Like I'd put out 20 pounds of seed a year on an acre of grass, really light, into the aeration holes, just to kind of introduce it. I'm not trying to force my grains to be bentgrass. I'm not doing anything extreme.
Sure. Right.
The thinking was that if I'm going to make it make a change to my management plan, like fertilizer, with the NLS and everything else, I don't want to have a mono stand. I want to have different species of grass in case the way that I'm changing don't favor Paula. And I wanted to have that insurance that I'm not going to wipe out all my greens if I do something drastic. And right. and last year, it paid off big time with anthracnose in the summer. The bentgrass. Bentgrass saved my ass on a few greens.
See? There you go. Right?
Yeah.
So we're so we're doing all the right things, sounds like to me. I mean,
hopefully
to that.
I might sound extreme to some people, but I'm pretty laid back as far as my management. I don't try to force anything. So, there's some guys who are on the bentgrass program, and there's some guys who are the POA, and there's not really guys who are like, whatever. And that's kind of where I am. I'm like, I want to have some bentgrass in them just in case, the conditions are favorable to bent over POA. And that's kind of what I roll with. It's with the amount that I roll my greens, it doesn't really matter what kind of grass you have on there. They're going to be fast. They're going to be smooth. So I'm not really worried about consistency at all.
Sure. Awesome. Yeah. All right. Let's talk about your use of, some of the cool stuff that I've seen you post about, even just in passing, is, you've been working with the moisture meter for a while. And I think a lot of people would say, well, in Western Canada, come on, dude. Like moisture meter, it's not the desert. It's not Kelowna or, any of that stuff either.
No,
what's the point?
We've had over 4 feet of rain this winter. we had a lot of rain, but come June, if we don't have water, our grass dies pretty quick. And I know that because I have a simple system. So my rough just gets smoked out every year. It's gone. And there's nothing I can do about it because I can't get water to it. Yeah. But what really kind of got me on to moisture meters was early on as a superintendent, I had to go away for a weekend to a funeral, which sucked. But that's beside the point. I go away. I come back, and it was like mid June, so we had high sun angles, everything else. I come back, and three of my greens are dead.
Wow.
And I later find out that, they were looking a little bit brown, and then, somebody comes out and turned the water on for 4 hours midday.
Uh-huh.
And at the time, I was young and inexperienced. I didn't really realize why the greens died, but I later learned that, yeah, you basically cook them. The grass is stressed, and then you cover them in water.
And right. And make
so
soup.
So midsummer. Midsummer, I feel like an idiot. And I'm like, you know what? And my irrigation system was and it still is horrible. I was like, I can't afford to do a new irrigation system, and we can't afford to lose greens. We need to know. And that was a long time ago. That was before the TDRs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was like the main one was like, you know, like there, I don't know, there was this old moisture probe that you stick in and had this like this analog dial, you know, it's like wet or dry. It was really lame. I didn't use that, but what I went to the nursery industry and I got this, I think I've shown pictures on my blog, this like crazy sensor that's meant to be like permanently installed.
Right. Yep.
But we would just hammer it in with a rubber mallet into the ground, and it would take like literally a minute per reading.
Yeah.
But I figured, you know what, 4 or 5 minutes per green is worth it. So that's when we started using it. And then when the TDRs came out, I jumped on that right away.
Right.
And it's funny because the local superintendents here and you know, they were a little bit slower to come on, but now they're all on board, and now they have better moisture meters than I have because they have bigger budgets and but that's good because it's cool. It's one of those tools. Well, it's like anything in our industry. There's all these crazy gimmicks, right?
Yep.
And there is a such thing as too much data. And like, man, I've collected so much stuff, and I look back and I'm like, what's the point of this data? This is useless.
Yeah.
So yeah, I see where everybody's coming from. But now that it's kind of like, oh, this is actually a useful tool, it's one of those things that can actually make a huge difference. And last year especially, it paid off. Everybody, you had to have one last year with the drought we had. So.
Uh-huh. I see. Now, I love this conversation because, you know, I work in some areas that can be wet areas, but we also, you know, in a lot of places in the Western U.S., you know, there's the drought's been on, and you know, you're just not going to get rain for periods of time.
Yeah.
And so people start to talk to me about wet and dry, and I'm like, let's quantify that a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
And now we can, and it's like, and I don't understand why anybody wouldn't do that. Right. And, especially when you're dealing with staff members and stuff, like, you know, what is dry and teaching them what the, you know, the thresholds are so important.
Well, that's the biggest thing for me. Like, I used to collect the data of moisture meters and have people write it down. I don't do that anymore. People might be surprised. I don't care what the numbers are. All I care is if they are too high or too low.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're too low, fix it. The guys are out watering. You moisture, you sense it. And our number is 20% on our greens. If it's below 20, water it. And then check it again. And if it's still below 20, hit it again. And I don't want to know unless, and if the number is over 25, that's when I want to know.
Yeah.
So that's when I turn the water down. Or if the guy will come up and say, like, you know, the third green, it's dry everywhere. Okay, I'll bump it up a bit.
Yeah.
But I'm not really concerned in like keeping the information because it doesn't really help me in day to day.
Sure.
Like looking back at what the moisture was on August 5th, it was dry. But
I agree. That may not be the most important use of that data, but the real time, the near real time monitoring, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Super.
And like I can give an experienced guy, and he can have a green perfectly watered.
Right.
With that tool.
Right. Yeah. Good point.
Yeah.
That it brings a level of expertise into the program. Sure.
I agree. And I think that's where other local guys are really seeing the advantage is that they can give it to their staff members, and now they can delegate that part of the thing, and they can trust that it's going to be done right. Where in the past there was so much required experience, and we can't, honestly, I don't think many guys can afford to have, you know, mm-hmm. staffs with six, you know, turf grass trained guys on it anymore. It's, you know, a lot of it's just the single superintendent with a bunch of untrained help.
Yeah.
So yeah. The moisture meter's sweet for that.
A big deal. Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Next topic that's on my list. Let's talk about, let's go a little more into fertility. And I mean, you've embraced the global soil survey work that Micah Woods and Larry Stoll have done. And and therefore the MLSN stuff. Tell me about that. Tell me how that's gone for you.
Well,
and,
you know, well, let's just start, you know, like, I can't thank Micah and Larry enough. You know, the openness that they've had with sharing information is insane. You know, people should be paying Micah Woods tens of thousands of dollars every year for the amount of information he is sharing openly with no expectation of being paid. It's unbelievable.
And exactly.
It's objective. He's not selling anything. It's crazy. So, you know, just to that, that kind of is my appreciation. Thanks, Micah. And I got to meet him last year at the U.S. Open, so it was pretty cool.
Oh, but anyways. Yeah.
And I just recently did a talk for the superintendents down in Seattle about my experience with the MLSN, and it really has changed the way I fertilize my golf course. It's kind of given me just a better understanding of what I'm doing. I wouldn't say necessarily that it's reduced the amount of fertilizer I use in a huge way. The biggest amount of fertilizer reductions I've made has been simply by using soluble source nutrients, right? Going out with urea, which is, you know, 46% nitrogen. So it's, I'm getting, you know, very concentrated product and then diluting it out and everything else. But with MLSN, like going back to the very beginning, it was something, and I might be the first person in the world to use this soil, the specific soil guideline, because the second I saw it, I was using it.
You were on top of it.
It was like, this makes so much sense to me. Yeah, I'm doing that. And the reason, and like the talk that I recently did, I talked about why I was able to make a decision like that. And a lot of it comes just the course I'm at. It's pretty low key, you know, like, and I'd also witnessed at a neighboring course that had quite a bit of financial difficulty for a few years where they weren't applying pretty much any fertilizer and the grass wasn't dying until it died. So, you know, I go, he calls me out and we're good friends. He calls me out, "Hey, my greens are dying after aerates," and they weren't recovering. And I'm like, "Holy smokes." So anyways, we figure out a company that can do the free soil test, and he's got like no calcium in his greens, like none. And so we go out and he buys a bulk bag of Dollar Pearl, applies the Dollar Pearl, and the greens come back like within a week. They're great. And so I'm like, okay, worst case scenario is these MLSN guidelines are wrong. And I start to notice something. And then I go back to the way thing I was doing it before. But so that kind of reassured me, you know, I've got lots of excuses at my course, a low budget and lower expectations. And I had seen that if things go bad, just go, you know, apply the nutrients and it'll get better. So that's what I did. And I haven't looked back. Things have only gotten better. Like I can't say it's because of the MLSN, but I can say that the successes that I've had and the ease of maintenance, I think that's the biggest thing, is like, I don't worry about that stuff anymore. It's just easy what I'm doing. It happened despite being on the MLSN.
And I think one of the things that you've really embraced, and like in your, again, reading your stuff, you know, is you understand the concept of growth potential. I mean,
that's been big for me. And that was kind of a mind blow too. When Micah first, shared that, with Larry's equation and everything else, but the way we were fertilizing was kind of how cool season grass grows in California. You know, in the spring and in the fall, you get a ton of growth, and in the summer it gets really hot and then it slows down. But that's not the way it works on the west coast of Canada.
We get
like very little growth in the spring, and then we get a ton in like our average temperature is like the optimum, or the average temperature in July and August, our hottest months, is the optimum cool season temperature for growth, which is around 20 Celsius, or I don't know, is that 70 Fahrenheit, somewhere around there, 68 or 70. And that kind of blew my mind, because I was pounding the grass with fertilizer in the spring, I was starving it through the summer, and then I was pounding it again in the fall. And that has a big, that had a big impact on diseases like anthracnose and dollar spot. So when I switched to growth potential, dollar spot's not an issue. I have anthracnose, but I can manage it without pesticides. Maybe the biggest impact on disease and pesticide use with the way I fertilize with growth potential and MLSN hasn't come in the wintertime because I'm not fertilizing, mm-hmm. but it's come in the summertime. Okay. So like, you know, last summer I didn't need any pesticide except for phosphite, you know, to be completely open. I use phosphite on a regular mm-hmm. just program. I just throw a little bit in the tank every time. Right. But I didn't use any corrective, or fungistatic,
sure.
products. And yes, it was a really dry year, but, I went from late April to late August without an app, uh-huh. which I had never done. And I had no dollar spot anywhere. And I had years where I got smoked, wiped out with dollar spot. A little bit of anthracnose, but that's probably because I hardly fertilize my grass. And,
sure.
And it was a tough summer. It was a tough summer. So
if somebody that had never, let's say, Jason, that you're, you know, speaking at a conference or somebody and a young guy walks up to you and says, I don't understand growth potential. I never heard of that before. How would you introduce that concept to somebody who's thinking about doing that on their golf course? What would you say?
You base your base fertilizer rates, nitrogen rates, which drives growth, which drives nutrient demand. Mm-hmm. You base it on the optimum temperature for grass. So there is a formula, and you can find that all on like AsianTurfGrass.com, like this site.
Sure.
It's pretty complicated, and to be honest, I couldn't tell you what that formula is off the top of my head.
I've
inputted it.
Yeah,
yeah. And Micah has a great little calculator that you can just plug in where you are and what the temperature is, and it'll spit out how much nitrogen you need to use and everything else. But I've created my own with a spreadsheet. It's basically just fertilize the grass based on how much potential there is based on temperature for growth. And it's not a perfect system by any means.
No.
Because there's other factors like moisture levels and the amount of light versus shade, everything else that impact growth. How much nutrients are being released from organic matter.
Right.
So that's something that, you know, for the first couple of years, I was like, okay, let's test this system out. And I went religiously with the growth potential.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't waver. Whatever the formula said, that's what I did. That I wouldn't recommend. I just wanted to try it. What happens, right?
Right.
How good is this formula? The formula, the way I use it now is I still use it as kind of gets me in the ballpark. But then I use my eyes. I go out, I look, and I monitor growth rates, so I can say, holy smokes, the grass isn't growing very quick, but the growth potential should be 80. Maybe we're running a bit lean, so maybe I bump up the nitrogen. Or something I've experienced on my site is, if there's in the summer, there's rain in the forecast this week. Every time we get summer rain, mm-hmm. we get a huge growth flush. So this week, if I see rain in the forecast, I just put nothing out, zero.
Right.
As far as nitrogen goes, I'll put other products out, but I know that I'm going to get a nitrogen release from organic matter and just the flushing with the rain. So those are the kind of things that I've done with the growth potential. So it's just a baseline, but it kind of gets me in the ball. It gets me in the ballpark, anyways.
Yeah, it gets you in the ballpark at the right time. Right, so it's a timing tool as much as anything.
Well, no point in showing up at the ballpark at the wrong time, for a baseball game if nobody else is around to play, right?
Exactly.
So that's kind of the way.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the cool thing. Like with dollar spot, you know, it's worse when it's dry because the plant can't get the nitrogen, and it's also worse when you're limiting the nitrogen. So since I've done growth potential, I'm applying, you know, the most amount of nitrogen every week in July and August and September,
mm-hmm.
when I used to be starving it. And now I don't have dollar spot. It's just, I'm giving the plant what it needs during that time of month, of the year.
And then the other part of that picture then is your use of growth regulators. And so you know when to throw those into the program a little bit better, right? So didn't I read that your, wintertime growth regulator use has really helped you?
Yeah, so that's something I've been on. Like, I've used probably since 2012, pretty most of the winter. Yeah. But I really didn't make too much of it, really. And then, you know, like another local or ex superintendent now, Jason Hooper. Because I was sharing it, now he says, "Oh, hey, I'm doing that too," and I'm like, "Oh, I'm not the only one." And so, you know, I was able to learn some stuff off of him. You know, at the last when I was down in Seattle, a couple of other guys are doing it. But these are the crazy things that people aren't talking about in the industry, right? That's the, you know, when you go and you meet them face to face, you get these things out of them.
Yeah.
But that's kind of what's been helpful with the blog for me, is because I don't get a chance to meet with a lot of other people. So anyways, yeah, growth regulators in the winter. So this year I really kind of took it to the extreme. I really dialed down my fertilizer in the fall, you know, using the growth potential as a guide and just hitting the primo on the 250 growing degree day schedule, which in the winter is like every 2 months, right? And, you know, I went 107 days without mowing my greens. And the longest I'd ever gone before that in the history of the golf club was 55 days.
Right.
And we had a warm winter.
Mm-hmm.
We had a really warm winter. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea is, back to my fusarium, was the fusarium me thoughts, was to limit the spread of the disease.
Yeah.
So if I can not mow, I theoretically don't spread the disease around. And that was something that I also learned by counting the disease, is I realized that, you know what, fusarium really isn't that bad of a disease in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. Like, yes, it's devastating if it gets out of control, but it we're making it worse by spreading it with mowers. So right. With the growth regulators, I'm not spreading it by mower. I don't think rollers, like the lightweight rollers, I don't think they spread it as much as mowing.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason I say that is because I ride my roller up my approaches, which are just caked in fusarium every day.
Yeah, yeah.
In the wintertime, or every day that I roll. And there's no more disease at the front of the greens or where I enter with the roller than anywhere else. So I don't think the roller spreads disease. But this year I've never had such an easy winter as far as disease goes.
Like
it is embarrassingly easy. I get pictures from other guys who are just getting smoked. I put out an app of propiconazole in late October. I put out a heritage as oxystrobin in late January, and then I put out interface last 2 weeks ago, and like, I got disease on my greens because I always do. I always have disease on my greens because I don't preventatively apply.
Because you're not masking anything, right?
No, but so I always got disease. But like it's oh man, it's they're beauty right now. It's unbelievable. I couldn't be happier. And
but I mean, if you look at like on paper, right? If you say to somebody, hey, you know, here it is in the wintertime. Here's how it works for me. And I'm applying a growth regulator, you know, like on what you just explained about growing degree days, and you have the, you know, you have the lowest photo period, you know, as far as number of hours of photo period ever, you know, during that period of time. It's like, whoa, what are you doing? And then you kind of look at that a little harder and you say, that's brilliant. I mean, that's the way to do that, because I haven't been on my greens for 100 days with the mowers. Such a brilliant result of, you know, stacking the Legos together the right way.
Yeah, you know, and I hear about other people having success with it. You know, I guess the disadvantage is that if you do get a bad outbreak, like if you do get caught with your pants down, it's not going to recover as quickly.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know if that's 100% true, because I'm also not fertilizing. I have put out 8 pounds of ammonium sulfate on an acre of grass since October. So pretty much nothing.
Eight pounds of total product on an acre.
Of total product.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and right now, like, they are as green as can be. It's ridiculous. And part of that is because of the pigment in interface, which I'm not a fan of, but, yeah, they're really waking up and not giving them a ton of push.
You know, Jason, there's a whole industry of people who don't want to hear what you're talking about because they're not going to. Those guys that are selling that stuff are thinking 8 pounds an acre for the year.
Yeah,
you know, that's
well, that's another deal. Thing. Like there's been some hostility out there. It's quite quiet, but I know it's there. Mm-hmm. About what I'm talking about, and it's mm-hmm. I understand it. But from this fertilizer industry and everything else. But my I guess rebuttal is the biggest reductions I've made is simply because I'm using soluble fertilizer. Now that's not for everybody, right? It requires quite a bit of thought. Like the reason I do it is because I'm really interested in it. And I'm really trying to figure out what's happening here, but that's not for everybody. Mm-hmm. People can use blended fertilizer still. The MLSN doesn't say don't apply fertilizer. You know, you're still applying product, right. But you just want to keep it above those guidelines. So yeah. I think, I've told people this, that the first salesman who sell fertilizer that really get on board, understand the MLSN, how it works, mm-hmm. and they can tailor their products to the superintendent's individual needs, the course needs, their soil sample needs, and tailor their products. They're going to be the ones that are going to really do well. Because, I'm not applying less. Well, in some instances, I'm applying less nutrient.
Sure you are.
But eventually, I'm going to have to apply, a well-rounded, balanced fertilizer because I'm going to deplete the reserves in the soil. And it doesn't take long. It really, like for potassium, it was like a year. Mm-hmm. You know, all of a sudden you're like, whoa.
Yeah.
And
I think that's really a good point, Jason, is the MLSN is not a no fertilization scheme. And it is not it's not ignoring that some soils are sandy and some soils are heavy. You know, things like that. It's ignoring none of those things. It's just saying, hey, there needs to be some thought here about what the minimums are. And that's an important point that I promised Micah that I would continue to make. With all that,
yeah, and it, you know, just being aware of those minimums, stay above them, like what I do, the crazy stuff I do, which is somewhat using them as targets, which is not recommended, but I have some other crazy thoughts about using them as targets. So that doesn't mean that you're going to sell less fertilizer. I think that the first salesmen who really understand it and embrace it are going to get the most business from everybody else because they're really going to, the people, like the superintendents who are being educated, they're educating themselves on this, right. are going to appreciate it, are going to appreciate the help.
And the formulators and everybody else following suit, you know? And
yeah, exactly.
And so, you know, probably your biggest risk, and I know it was mine when everybody heard I wasn't using pesticides and I'd stopped doing preventatives and, you know, a lot of the things that you're saying, like that was my world. Is I got a lot of heat from that world for sure. I mean, that continued. I still have the label, you know, Dave hates pesticides, right?
Yeah. And, that worries me. It worries me. And it does pain me when I share, you know, what I spend and how much less I spend.
Yeah.
Cause I know it does impact these guys' lives, but at the same time, I know that there's opportunity out there for them to be creative. Like I've been creative to make it work.
Instead of
fighting the MLSN, I think if you embrace it and give your customer what they want, you are still going to make a good living. And I'm not spending, you look at my supplies budget. Yes, I'm spending a lot less on fertilizer, but guess what? Now I can use wetting agents on my fairways.
Right.
Where I couldn't before.
Exactly. There's the point.
Right.
Is it's not like
so,
the
you know,
completely evaporates, but it gets reutilized. Yes.
Reutilized so that, you know, I'm not overwatering my course and it's just better distributed.
Well, and let's be fair about the business too, Jason. Those guys, those three, four guys that are working for you, I mean, they need to be paid to do that job. And they want, and we need them to be happy doing the job and paid accordingly. So, you know, there's the human factor that everybody kind of forgets, which I think is incredibly important. So, you know, but I always cared about my guys,
Me too. Yeah.
Right? I had to. And especially in a smaller community, you have to.
And I could go back to spending what I did on certain products, but I'd be out of business right now.
Yeah.
So guess what? All of my accounts would be completely wiped off. You'd be getting zero from me. So, I know that for a fact.
There it is, right? The golf course is open.
We're open, and guess what? We're making money, I can confidently, you know, make purchases from you guys still, where some guys, you know, courses are disappearing. And,
that's what sustainability to me really means, is that a place like yours gets to stay open. It's really cool, man.
Yeah. Well, we read about it every day. Courses closing, and you kind of learn about it a little bit, you know, a snippet of what they're doing, and it's like, oh, they had 50 staff. I'm like, 50 staff? Yeah. Like, no wonder he went into business. But you know, there's a whole bunch of other things involved with it. But
all right, let's do a quick. Yeah. Let's do, as we get in close to the end of our time here, let's do a quick lightning round, and I'll ask you some quick questions, and you can give me your quick answers. And here we go. Favorite food?
Lasagna.
Lasagna, nice. Do you have kids? You mentioned kids. You have kids?
I have two kids. One's 5 and one's 1.5.
Oh boy! Oh boy! Yeah. What putter is in your golf bag right now?
I don't have a putter. I'm in between putters.
What? What are you putting?
My brother. I'm pretty sure my brother stole my putter and lost it.
Okay.
And because he works for me, and he is a really avid golfer.
Ah, there we go.
So okay. I'm pretty sure somebody. Anyways, it's gone. So the last golf time I golfed, I used my son's putter, which is about 1.5 feet long. And nice. I'm 6'4", so it was a bit of a joke, but
brilliant.
Yeah, you know, I'll be looking for a new putter this spring.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
Let's see. What golf ball do you prefer to play with?
Whatever's free.
Whatever you find. Okay.
Yeah.
Favorite non-golf sport?
Mountain biking.
Okay. And Star Trek or Star Wars?
Goodness. I don't know, Star Wars, I guess. But
what? You don't care?
After that newest episode, I'm not too pleased. But
what? I loved it.
I'm a fan of the original three. Let's say that.
Okay, there we go. I like that. I can get with that. Let's see. Stones or Beatles?
Beatles. And it's mostly just because there's a lot of hippies out here. So I kind of grew up with the hippie culture a little bit, and it was all about the Beatles when I was in high school, and I do enjoy the Stones though.
So Fish or the Dead?
The Dead.
Oh, good for you. You answered that correct. So not the neo hippie kind of thing. That's awesome.
No, I actually did listen to the Grateful Dead quite a bit. I've never really gotten into Fish, so
there we go. Okay, well now we know a lot more about you, Jason. I'm so stoked to be able to spend this time with you, man. I feel all lit up, and I feel excited. I get, you know, when I speak to somebody like you, it just, I hate to sound like the old guy here, but it just reminds me of me when I was 30. You know, and I know it can be a lonely place sometimes, you know, especially when you're kind of geographically isolated, but let me tell you what, you have a lot of friends out there. You know, a lot of people that are behind you and with you. It's a good thing.
It's been a lot of fun. It's been a lot of fun what I've been doing, and I hope people don't take me too seriously and realize that, you know, I'm just trying to have some fun out here and trying to learn a few things along the way.
I don't think any of us that have this turfgrass lifestyle kind of thing, you know, in our blood, the serious moments are fine, you know, I mean, it all makes sense. But clearly you're thinking about this, and applying those thoughts. And that just says a lot for the kind of person that you are. And I'm sure the same thing goes for parenting or for the, you know, SNR stuff or whatever, you know, you sound like the kind of guy who applies himself, right?
Yeah. I try not to just talk the talk. I try to I don't know, maybe that's my generation kind of thing. Even though, you know, on the grand scale of things, it probably doesn't really matter, but it, it definitely matters to me, and yeah. I want to do the best that I can anyway. So
cool. Well, I'm sure, yeah. I'm sure that you've inspired some people today, and I know that you and I will chat again. As always, we're going to get, you know, some questions. There'll be some stuff around all this. We're going to hear some opinions, and and it'll drive, you know, the next conversation. So
that excites me. I got, it was a lot of fun, and I look forward to talking again, because there's a lot of stuff I gotta get off my chest.
Well, good. We'll get to that, because today I wanted to be a little bit more mechanical and introduce you, but I do want to get to some, you know, some philosophical stuff and some things like that, some, you know, some of those deeper meta conversations that a lot of people want to hear. So, okay,
good. Cool.
All right, Jason. Well, listen, you have an exceptional day, and I appreciate you spending some time of your day with me today.
Yeah, that was awesome. Thanks.
All right. Well, there you have it. Episode number 18 of the Turfgrass Zealot Project. And Jason Haynes, who, what a great guy, huh? I mean, don't you just want to hang out with him, talk about grass? I mean, you know he could do it 26 hours a day if you asked him to. So engaged and so cool about it all and just trying his heart out. You know, I don't want to get in my soapbox with this, but I'll tell you something. Our business is sometimes missing that. And when people tell me they're innovators and they got something new and something cool going on, man, I just want to point them at somebody like Jason and say, I mean, you know, here's somebody who's observing and taking care of business on his own place. It's pretty stunning. I love it. We got a lot of cool stuff coming up on the Turfgrass Zealot Project. Some fun episodes planned. I'm also hosting the renovation report for TurfNet Radio, which has been awesome. We have good guests lined up there too. And we have a new series called The Ladder, talking about career advancement and sort of pointed at that whole millennials thing, which I helped get that conversation started along with Chris Stridabaugh and some others. So good things happen in the TurfNet universe, the forums coming alive, that time of year for all this sort of stuff. I appreciate you listening. I appreciate you being part of the Turfgrass Zealot Project. It means the world to me. And I hope you have a great and wonderful day. And you can return to your life of killing grass. Take care.